Hello, welcome to The Moment That Made Me, this time.
I was young and naive, not very tactically trained at that time. There was a necessity, political necessity, for a military victory. And so Goose Green really set the tone for that.
A young platoon commander leads the first troops into combat for the decisive battle of the Falklands War.
We've been told at some stage that there were no enemy helicopters left on the islands. They'd all been shot down. And suddenly we're seeing this fleet of enemy helicopters coming in with their strategic reserves. The reality, when you look back, is that war is a dung heap, but it's a dung heap from which remarkable blooms grow.
The 28th of May 1982 was the moment that made Major General Chip Chapman.
As a 23-year-old platoon commander in Tupara, I'd been sponsored through university by the Army, so I always knew I was going to join the Army, and I'd been in Liverpool OTC, Officer Training Corps, and I'd learnt how to strip and assemble an SLR, self-loading rifle, and put on my putties. And for that reason, we were all graduates who'd done that route and were put on a 17-week course at Sandhurst called the POSET course, the post-university course. Terribly small, short course, really. And unusually in those days, the parachute regiment, of course, which I was in, didn't send their short service career officers, and I was only in the Army for 3 years, to the platoon commander's battle course, which now would be a mandatory stage 2 requirement. So we were really on-the-job training sort of officers. So I was young and naive, not very tactically trained at that time. It was really the bookend, one bookend of my career. Now, having said that, in late 81, I joined the battalion in June 81. We were in Kenya for 6 weeks and did a lot of live-firing training, most of which would be deemed to be illegal today. And I think it was really rather like Wellington and saying that the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton. For Tupara, in my view, a lot of it was won on the plains and savannas of Kenya in November and December 81. But we became a pretty ruthless machine as a battalion, a companies and platoons. And that set us in great store for what would happen from May 82 onwards.
Can you remember what went through your mind when you knew that you were being sent to war?
Well, it was more intriguing than that in lots of ways, because the two para junior officers and some of the senior NCOs and sergeants had actually gone to Belize in Central America. We were due to do a six-month tour there. And on the 23rd of March 1982, there was a junior officer's coup in Guatemala, and they reclaimed what was originally known as British Honduras. So actually, we thought, well, there was a fair chance of us going to war with Guatemala. And then on the 2nd of April, when the Argentinians invaded, we were in observation posts, OPs with the SAS, really, at the time, when we learned, and we were quickly called out and sent back to England. And to be honest, we were quite excited. You know, this was going to be a seminal moment, and all those silly questions which you think when you were young and naive, that, you know, how am I going to react in battle, and what will we be like? And all those things go for your mind. It wasn't all the notions of fear or we don't want to go there, because we were very highly motivated and highly trained and did want to go there. There's no doubt about that.
So the moment that made you was the battle for Goose Green. Can you tell me the context of it?
British troops had landed on the 21st of May in the Falklands, and by the 25th of May, we were kind of struggling. We were stopped on the beachhead, and the Royal Navy was suffering more casualties. On the 25th of May, which was really the seminal day, HMS Coventry was sunk. The Atlantic conveyor with the helicopters on board was sunk. Sheffield had already been sunk. Antelope in the bay had been sunk. And there was a perception in Whitehall that, you know, we needed to get on and do things because the Argentinians might be pushing for a ceasefire. So there was an absolute political necessity which drove a military necessity, direct order really to Julian Thompson, to get on and do something. And the closest garrison to the beachhead at San Carlos Water was Goose Green. So that set the context for Tupara marching off Sussex Mountain on the 26th of May with light order, no sleeping bags, any of that sort of stuff, getting to Camilla Creek House, and there doing the battle procedure for the attack early morning on the 28th of May.
So there you were, a platoon commander. What was your part in the attack plan?
Well, I was part of B Company Tupara. We were on the right flank, really, and our first engagement was going to be at a place called Low Pass, and then we were supposed to take a place called Bocker House. And then pause while the rest of the companies did nothing, did everything. So our part of the battle really was supposed to be over by the time we took Bocker House. Now, it didn't transpire like that. And really, there were sort of two battles, really. There was the battles which occurred when it was dark, when we were very successful. And there were the battles which occurred when it was light, when it was far more difficult, of course, to move. And the key thing about that is we were late crossing what now is called the line of departure, what in 1982 was the start line, because HMS Arrow, the naval gunfire ship that was in support of us, had a jammed 4.5-inch gun. So the necessity to try and clear that meant that we started the attack 30 minutes later. That chewed up 30 minutes of the darkness. And really, it was that transition from darkness to light when the battalion got in trouble with not having secured either Bocker House and over on the left flank, Darwin Hill, which was the objective for A Company.
And what do you remember about contact with the enemy?
Well, I remember it being absolutely exhilaratingly exciting, to be honest. Really, it started off with the own group, the orders group. It was very, very dark. It was very, very cold. The orders were very, very late. You know, the one-thirds, two-thirds battle procedure that the army talks about went for a ball of chalk. And really, it was almost a case of giving the orders on the hop to the bloke saying, you know, you're left forward, you're right forward, you're on reserve, there's a track on the left, there's a boundary, treat this as an advance contact. Anything that gets in the way, get rid of it. And we were really the first troops in contact at Goose Green when a strange, bizarre incident occurred when someone mentioned there's a scarecrow moving towards us. Now, in the orders, we've been told that we were going over the best arable ground in the Falklands. It was nonsense, of course, and I thought, well, visions of cabbage fields or carrots or something like that, and it was feasible that there might therefore be a scarecrow there. And, of course, there weren't cabbage fields and carrots at all. And there was a skitten, and someone said, the scarecrow is moving towards us, and it was a live Argentinian soldier. Don't know his motivation, but he was dispatched, and that set off a chain of events which led to us attacking an Argentinian position behind. It was very dark. This was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we were successful in neutralizing, using very benign language here, neutralizing that entire position without any losses. And it's really from that that I learned everything to do with cohesion and willpower in battle. So what happened after we dispatched the scarecrow were a lot of shimunis, that's pyrotechnics, light pyrotechnics, went up in the sky. The key thing really was seeing the fire maneuver of the sections going into action against the enemy. And I remember thinking at the time, wow, these guys are phenomenal. The way they used ground, the way they took cover, the way they fired, they were just like a machine let loose, and they were just phenomenal. And that's why the conclusion, successful conclusion to that initial engagement was so sort of electric for everyone, that we really did think that we were invincible for that, from that moment on. Now, there were times when that sort of sheen of invincibility sort of started wearing off. So, for example, when that transition from darkness to daylight did take place, and we'd crested a hill towards the Bocker House objective, and we were under heavy enemy fire, and we managed to get to the gorse line, which is just on our friendly force side of Bocker House. Bocker House probably 100 meters or so from that gorse line, and we were in a sort of good position in terms of we had cover from view and cover from fire, but there was just no way, because it was light, that I could maneuver towards the enemy without everyone just having a high percentage chance of being killed, unless something changed. And the something changed, of course, was either maneuver from other people, other companies around the flanks, or from bringing additional firepower up, which, again, I think what broke the will of the Bocker House position was bringing some Milan anti-tank missiles up, which hit the bunkers of the enemy, which made their bravery pills sort of dissipate, and they were up for surrendering pretty quickly after that.
So, Chip, 18 British men lost and up to 55 Argentinian killed in this. How close did it come, do you think, to defeat?
Everything always hinges on a knife edge. The key thing for me was the ruse in war, which Chris Keeble managed to achieve.
He was the commander that took over the operation, wasn't he?
He was. And the reason I say that is the third thing that happened when we'd outflanked the enemy and got to the rear, this is B Company 2 Power, was that a bunch of enemy helicopter reinforcements came in. I think they came in from Mount Kent. Now, that actually was both a physical and psychological event, because physically we could see that there were a lot of enemy helicopters coming in with reinforcements, and psychologically because we'd been told again at some stage that there were no enemy helicopters left on the islands. They'd all been shot down. And suddenly we're seeing this fleet of enemy helicopters coming in with their strategic reserves. And that mentally stopped us dead in our tracks, and we were expecting a huge counterattack. So the ratio of forces seemed to be tipped against us again, with the number of dead and wounded that we already had, when they had a fresh reserve coming in. So the fact that Chris Keeble could use later on in the night this ruse of war, that unless you surrender, we're just going to destroy you all with a firepower demonstration, was the thing which broke the will of the enemy to resist. Now, there was a reinforcement on the night of the 28th of May from the British, and it was a reinforcement of artillery. So I think an additional 900 rounds and more guns were brought forward to the just near Camilla Creek House, which were there available to do this firepower demonstration or obliterate Goose Green settlement. But thankfully, the will to resist had been broken of the Argentinians.
That thing that you talk about, the willpower there that you mention, I mean, how much did you learn about that from this experience?
Everything. That's what I absolutely believe in. You know, an ounce of optimism is worth more than a general reserve. And, we just were not going to be broken, and the enemy were broken. And again, as I say, what was really important was this energizing effect that this had for the rest of the task force. It was really, you know, match that to all the other units. And they absolutely wanted to match that, you know, both in terms of, you know, the Scots Guards at Tumbledown and certainly 3 Power, our parent battalion at London. They absolutely wanted to match what was seen as a famous victory at Goose Green. And of course, it was a famous victory in lots of ways, because if we'd have been defending that, they'd have got nowhere near us.
Because your enemy surrendered, didn't they? It was the moment that made you. It could have been the moment that killed you or broke you. How did it make you?
Well, it led to my fundamental beliefs about how you should use firepower for the future, cohere everything that you've got available to break the enemy in a physical sense, and the fact that everything you really need in the army to be successful is the mixture of that cohesion of the individual and the teams with the firepower that's available to you. If you can mesh that together, and ultimately if you could bottle all that, you'd have a strategic war-winning formula for any business anywhere in the world.
You talked about how when you knew you were going to war, about the anticipation and the excitement about it. What was the actual reality like compared to what you'd expected?
Well, of course, the reality when you look back is that war is a dung heap, but it's a dung heap from which remarkable blooms grow. And those blooms are all that comradeship and the will to survive and fight. And matehood, it's really people fight for those on the left and right. They don't really fight most of the time for grand objectives about king and country and prime ministers and things like that. Now, having said that, this was a just war, in my opinion, because sovereign territory had been invaded by Argentina in the Falklands. So I don't think anyone who went to the South Atlantic thought that we were potentially fighting for an unjust cause.
And you went on to command 2 Para before becoming head of counterterrorism and UK operations in the MOD. Are those the things you just mentioned? Did you apply those to your career afterwards?
I did. And I keep on talking about physical and psychological reminders. This was absolutely what I did when I was CO. So, for example, I carried a pistol, and I carried a pistol deliberately as a physical and psychological reminder to self that my job was command in the widest sense, that is leadership and decision making, to bring the combat power available to a battle group, whatever level you're at, to bear on the enemy. And that's why I carried a pistol.
And did it help?
It did. It was a reminder to self. And of course, I always got people in, subordinate commanders, company commanders, when we were planning something on operations, because you can have whizzo ideas, but ultimately the people who die are those who are going to have to execute the ideas. So it's always worth doing a check with those who are going to execute the mission to ensure that you've not missed something, because they're the ones who will suffer if you have missed something. Because, you know, just because you're the commander doesn't necessarily mean that we've got all the answers all the time.
And what have you learnt about warfare and about yourself as a result?
Well, I always say that there are three types in war. There are thrivers, there are stickers, and there are failures. There are people who just don't react very well in war. You know, not everyone's a hero. I learned that at least I was a sticker and could cope with the psychological stresses of war. Some people can't. And as I said, other people thrive within that. So it didn't lead me to obviously leave the army, and it led me to having a pretty long career. That doesn't mean that I, you know, people often say that because you're a general and you're in for a long time that you're a warmonger. But of course, the least warmonger is a randus are those who've been to war, because we know what it's like. And that's why, you know, deterrence is a far better posture than having to actually fight. Warfare is horrible. And if we can avoid it, then we should.
So, Chip Chapman, at the moment that made you was the battle for Goose Green in 1982. What can we learn from your moment?
Well, you can win. You can learn that will is everything. Cohere those teams, bring firepower to bear. If all that is together, then you're an unbeatable entity.
Chip Chapman, great to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kate.